Welcome to the Tom Dupree Show. This week, joining us, Adarsh Mashru and our host, Tom Dupree. And the conversation starter today is about commodities. Over to you, Tom.
So that's the music is the Locust Fork Band from Birmingham. They got started in the 70s. They played a lot of places, kind of college fraternity parties and things. And I know they played up at Sewanee a couple of times, and they never really hit the big time. They had an album or two, and you know, they're more local type band, but I love their music. There's not much of it out there, but what it is really good. Okay, Adarsh, it's just you and me today. Now, we've had extensive discussions about commodities and commodity prices over the years that you've been here and that we've been working together. And what we know is that it's pure supply and demand, because since commodities, unlike stocks, have no earnings that can be a game changer to push them higher, it's purely about who needs it and what price that it's going to be at. And certainly inflation or the value of the dollar would affect the pricing to some degree, but not always, because the dollars trade in their own universe and commodities trade in their own universe, and they happen to be denominated in dollars, but it's not just because of what dollars are doing that commodity prices get set. It's about supply and demand. And another thing we've sort of established and seen is that sometimes they can go in very long waves of bullish and bearish types of markets, sometimes even longer than stocks can go. And they have an interesting dynamic, because with any commodity which has to be produced, high prices bring more producers into the market, which creates a surplus, which creates low prices, which pushes people out of the market, which then creates a scarcity and drives prices higher again. And so it kind of goes back and forth, because people who are in the business of producing commodities, it tends to be very much of a boom and bust business. And that would apply to oil production, people who mine precious metals, and farmers, people who, you know, produce agricultural crops and things like that. So it's an interesting market.
It really is. And you know, commodities are back in vogue again. When you think about what has transpired over the last 10 years, really, you know, we've had what you would call a bear market. That's the, you know, term that you would apply to the stock market, but we've had a bear market in commodities over the last decade. If you remember going back to 2008, right before, right around the time of the financial crisis, crude oil prices shot up to $147 a barrel briefly. And here we are, you know, 14 years later. They just a few weeks ago, they briefly went back there. But in the interim, it was one long downward move. So there were periods back in 2014, it rose again, went briefly over 100, and then again went down. But the trend has been downward. So as you said, they tend to move in these long cycles. They're primarily driven by demand and supply. But the dynamics of, you know, how demand changes or how supply changes is different for different commodities. So, for example, crude oil, you know, there's a big cartel called the OPEC, which historically has been quite impactful when it comes to the price of crude, because they are a consortium of major oil-producing nations, and they oftentimes decide how much they're going to supply into the market, so that can impact the price of crude.
Try to function in a monopolistic way,
yes,
to some degree.
And interestingly, over the last decade, the U.S. has become a major player again. The U.S. used to be a big player back, you know, 70s.
I mean, theoretically, we should be a member of OPEC.
Yes.
I mean, really, if you think, because we're importing oil and exporting oil, and
right.
I mean, we have been, and we're producing as much as many of, way more than many of the Middle Eastern countries.
Right. That's true, yes. So the U.S. has become a significant player in oil and gas, a lot of it driven by technology, horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracking and such. And also there was a lot of capital that went into the oil and gas industry in the previous decade, which resulted in surplus production. But since then, we've seen a lot of capital come out of it. And here we are, you know, a decade later, and now, you know, there's not enough supply. So the dynamics of the energy market are different from, say, the agriculture market, because crop production can be impacted by the weather. You know, some one year there's, you know, right, not enough rain, or there's a drought, and all of a sudden crop prices, you know, fluctuate. They're also impacted by fertilizer prices, you know, and then the input in fertilizers varies. So if it's a nitrogen-based fertilizer, then natural gas prices can impact. So the point being that the commodity market is unlike the stock market, where all markets are ultimately driven by demand and supply, but the factors that impact demand and supply are different. And unlike the stock market, where you just buy and hold on, if you buy good companies, you hold them for a long time, there's a good chance that they'll keep growing their earnings and right, you know, keep becoming bigger and bigger. The same dynamic does not necessarily apply to commodity markets. Now, there are companies, good companies, that are in the business of producing some of these commodities. We saw, you know, for a few decades, a company like ExxonMobil or BP or Shell, they did pretty well, and, you know, their shareholders did well. But then there were also periods where they did not do as well. Same with coal companies, you know, they did well for decades, and then they had a few really bad decades. So it's important to be your timing when it comes to buying commodities has to be good. And it's important not to jump into it just because prices have gone up. And we've seen that. And it's not just the recent war in Ukraine that has made prices go up, although that has been a factor. Commodity prices have been going up since last year. If, you know, people remember, lumber prices shot up like crazy last year. Copper prices went up a lot. And now we are in a situation where, because prices in the previous decade were so low, companies just did not invest in increasing their capacity. So perhaps we are in the beginning stages of, a bull market. We don't know that. There's no way to know that. We'll only know that, you know, in hindsight. But the last year has definitely been, commodities have been a good place to be in. And commodities as an asset class is coming back. It used to be where people invested in stocks, bonds, real estate, commodities. People seem to have forgotten about commodities because prices have gone nowhere. But now it seems to be coming back.
Couple of things I wanted to mention. So you can invest in the raw commodity, or you can invest in companies that create the commodity. So if you invest in an oil company, you're not necessarily investing in oil itself. You're investing in the business that produces oil or refined product, and you're leveraged to the price of oil, assuming that that company will either earn more or less based upon the price of the commodity. Same thing with silver mining and gold mining and things like that. So I wanted to ask you about one thing. Some are saying that the reason the oil and gas industry has not jumped back into completely high gear producing oil is because back 2014, when the market crashed, there was a lot of capital destruction in the industry because there weren't good disciplines in place. And some are saying that investors and boards of directors have required that oil companies have better capital disciplines in place this time around. Therefore, they're not just going to go out and drill a lot of wells on borrowed money or raising capital willy-nilly, knowing that if the commodity price were to pull back in a big way, they could be losing money very quickly.
Yes, and there is a lot of truth to that, because when you think about it, at the end of the day, just because a company produces a commodity does not mean that it's not a business and that it does not need to make prudent decisions like other businesses. So in the previous decade, we saw a lot of capital go into it. A lot of new players emerged who were not disciplined at all. And their solution, offset their decline in profitability because of lower prices was just to produce more.
Pump more.
Yes.
And then it made the market go even lower.
Exactly. So it became a vicious downward cycle. And since then, a lot of these smaller players have just gotten out of business because they just could not service their debt.
I remember when we went to Houston, I think it was 2014, market was expensive. A lot of people in the business. And I remember we drove by this company, and there was a sign out, it was called Cobalt. And I started doing some research. Had about a $4 billion market cap. And when you really got to looking at it, they had almost very few prospects. They weren't producing much oil and gas. I think Goldman Sachs or somebody had taken them public. They'd had a lot of private equity money. Got some people that were probably veterans of other oil companies. They said, we're going to get together and create this thing and get some leases around the world and go in business. And they went in business at the perfect time. So the value of that company was $4 billion. Today it's zero, and it's been zero for several years. And I knew they were not going to make it because they weren't a real company. But that is an indication of the kind of crazy capital that was flowing into the energy business back 8 years ago.
Right. And, that's something that we see time and again. It's always a little different. So this time around, we saw crazy capital flow into tech companies, especially last year, these new companies, entities,
SPACs. During the pandemic.
And during the pandemic, yes. So people piled on, people, celebrities started making their own SPACs, and SPAC stands for Special Purpose Acquisition Corporation. So it became this new trend where everyone was coming out with a new SPAC, and a lot of capital went into it. There was a lot of demand, and then ultimately there has to be that incremental buyer, but once that incremental buyer is not there, the whole thing unravels. And here we are a year later, some of these stocks are down 80-90%.
Hey, you know what I think? A lot of that was driven by boredom.
And that's probably true.
They had right. time on their hands, and they had a little extra money, and they opened a Robinhood account.
Right.
Anyway, and they get on that board on the internet that would tell everybody which stock to buy each day. Right.
Yeah, so social media, interestingly, has created this new Reddit, yes, new dynamic where information travels so fast. So unlike a few decades ago, even when the dot-com bubble burst, it took almost 2 years for prices to gradually decline and bottom out. But because information travels so fast, even financial markets seem to be acting very fast, where things on the way up go up rapidly and come down rapidly again. The basic, dynamic remains the same. You know, there's a new trend, and then there is people that pile on, then there's greed, and then there comes a point where people who got into it early start selling your so-called smart money, and then people are left holding the bag, and, prices decline, and then oftentimes they just don't come back. There are stocks today that are below where they were in the year 2000, 22 years later, big tech companies.
So going forward, how would you advise someone, that sees these commodity prices up, they're interested, and typically people get interested after
right.
prices have already gone up. They don't really get interested when something's in a bear market. Very right. few people really do.
Right.
So what would you say to folks that, perhaps are saying, I'm interested right now?
So if you think of commodity as an asset class where you say, okay, I own stocks, bonds, I also want to own commodities, then you have to educate yourself on how best to invest in it. So as you said earlier, there's investing in the actual commodity, and then there's investing in the companies that produce these commodities. So unless you're a sophisticated investor, investing in the actual commodity is a very difficult game, because you have to either trade in the futures market. Most commodities, by the way, are traded in the futures market. Now there are ETFs where you can own the commodity directly. But if you do that, and if your timing is wrong, then you could be stuck in a commodity that goes nowhere for years. So for example, Arabica coffee back in 1977 was trading at $3.50, 35 cents a pound. And I guess almost 50 years later, 40 odd years later, it's trading at $2.24 a pound. So it's gone nowhere for such a long time.
The dollar has... So it was really trading at more like 15 bucks.
Exactly, yes.
Compared to today.
Yes. So you have to understand, A, the difference between investing in a company that produces the commodity, which generates cash flow, perhaps pays a dividend, versus the actual commodity. B, stay away from things like leveraged ETFs, where they say, okay, if this commodity goes up X percent, you'll make a 3X gain by investing in an ETF.
Or leveraged or highly leveraged companies, because
yes.
anytime you leverage against the value of a commodity,
right.
you're taking a risk.
Right.
Or against what you think you can sell the commodity for.
Right. Also diversify, don't just put all your eggs in one basket. Don't invest, just pick one commodity. You could invest in multiple commodity companies if you so wish, or you could invest in a commodity ETF. If you invest in companies, research those companies, understand exactly what they do, make sure that they're not extremely leveraged to the commodity,
right.
And make sure that they are disciplined.
Yeah. I mean, they're in a business like any other kind of business. It's almost like a restaurant. The restaurant's serving food. These guys are serving oil, you know.
Right, right.
I mean, it's, you know, they're going to get whatever the price is for that. The value add is going to be how well they manage their business and how well they discipline themselves in the use of capital.
Right, exactly. Commodities, you know, is an interesting market because it draws the price movements in commodities can be exponential, you know. So it does tend to draw a lot of people. In the late 70s leading up to early 80s, gold prices skyrocketed. A lot of people got in gold and silver. And the Hunt brothers famously, you know, cornered the silver market and silver prices shot up to $50 an ounce. So a lot of people got in. And prices peaked, and then they did not recover. It took
the Hunts cornered silver, and the government cornered the Hunts.
Right,
that's what happened. They changed the margin requirements on them.
That's right. Yep.
It's time for a break. You're listening to the Tom Dupree Show with Adarsh Mashru. If you want to hear more of the Tom Dupree Show, you can always find it at DupreeFinancial.com under the Radio and Blog tab. We just start promoting that on iHeartRadio, on our ads you'll hear on WLAP. They will give you more directives on how to find our podcast in addition to finding it at DupreeFinancial.com. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more of the Tom Dupree Show. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Tom Dupree Show. Joining us today, Adarsh Mashru and Tom Dupree. And our conversation starter for this half of the hour is the LNG export boom draining U.S. natural gas supplies and lifting prices. I know we've got varying opinions on this one. So what say you, Tom?
All right. Well, this music is Mona Lisa Twins. And that's kind of my favorite girl group out today. Those and Larkin Poe. But this is God Only Knows, which is from the Beach Boy album called Pet Sounds. And some have said this may be the greatest album to ever come out in popular / rock music. Period. The Beatles were envious of this.
Talk about the Beach Boys album
called Pet Sounds. Yeah. It's got an incredible, the lineup of there's just nothing like it. It's so some of the songs on there are Wouldn't It Be Nice? Find that one. The Sloop John B. Oh my God, that's a heck of a song. And, you know, it's just an incredible album. And I mean, I don't know why I get off on talking about it, but it's just, yeah, well, all right, I was trying to play it, and then you get a daggone ad. All right, let's go to our subject here. The LNG export boom is draining U.S. natural gas supplies and lifting prices. All right, now, we have, you know, we're not draining our gas supplies. That's just not correct. You know, they get these people write these daggone articles for the Wall Street Journal, and they're probably very young reporters or correspondents, and they put a title on there designed to sort of get your attention. The state of Colorado, that's one state, big state, but it's one state, supposedly has enough natural gas to fuel the whole country for 100 years. There is plenty of natural gas out there. You know, you got Texas, Louisiana, pretty much every state probably has some natural gas in it at some place. It's easy to find. You don't have to mine it like you do coal. You don't have to pump it out of the ground like you do gas and then refine it. You can put it in the pipeline, clean it up a little bit, and typically you then have somewhere around 1,000 BTU per MCF. That's per 1,000 cubic feet. And the BTU is the measurement of actual energy in it. And it burns with a blue flame because you get the impurities out of it, which can also be used for other things. Benzene, the liquids have a value. Not as much as, well, probably it's gone up now with gasoline prices. So I disagree that we're draining our natural gas supplies. I take issue with the title of this article. However, I think it's a very wise business to liquefy natural gas and send it to Europe because it says here $5.33 per million BTUs or per 1,000 MCFs at 1,000 BTU. Same thing, they're around $5.33. In Europe, it's $20-$25 per MCF or somewhere in there. Why would you not take advantage of the arbitrage? You would. And so, therefore, you know, we're sending natural gas to Europe. It's going to help our pipeline companies like a Kinder Morgan, which sends natural gas through the pipe. The pipeline companies maybe 10, 15 years ago overbuilt. There was a lot of, you know, capital that went into the industry. Stuff got built. And then as a result of the overcapacity, the shipping tariffs went lower. Over time, the industry will rationalize itself. You'll have some people maybe go broke or get sold. The pipelines will get into the hands of fewer and fewer, and then they will return to having pricing power, the ability to raise prices for what they do. So those are going to be good investments. But, I mean, you know, it seems to me that it's smart to export natural gas in this environment.
Absolutely. Makes perfect sense. I mean, I think part of the reason why they're talking about the shortage of supply is just, as you said, there's enough natural gas in the country. You know, there's data that shows that. It's just that the demand for natural gas has gone up all of a sudden because of this war. And the gas that is in storage relative to what is normally in storage is dwindling. But
Adarsh, In 2008, when oil hit 148, natural gas got to $15 right. per. We have had, that's 14 years, and the technology has improved so much during that time with horizontal drilling and things like that, that now oil is at 100 and change. And by on that comparison, natural gas ought to be around 10, and it's at 5 and change.
That's true, yes. That's a good point. And that's largely because of how much supply there is, because of the abundance and because of the technological improvements that have made it easier to get some of this natural gas. What has been different between oil and gas is that crude oil typically crossed borders through ships, through tankers. And natural gas has always been a very localized market historically. So natural gas usually ships via pipes. Even in Europe got most of their natural gas from Russia and some of the ex-Soviet Union countries, other countries near Russia.
Plus the North Sea.
And because of all these technological improvements in the U.S., natural gas prices dropped so much so that it became economical to liquefy the natural gas and start shipping it just like you would crude oil. And we are starting to see that. The reason why...
So let me ask you a question. What is the process whereby natural gas is liquefied and then shipped? How does that work?
There's a word for it. I can't remember the word. But basically, I guess
it's extreme pressurization.
Yes.
And it becomes very cold.
It becomes extremely cold. And then it liquefies. And then you store it in a different kind of container. And then you ship it.
Right. And once it's taken out of its liquid state and allowed to go to room temperature, then it'll turn back into the gaseous form.
Right, exactly. What has been a hindrance to start shipping natural gas outside of the U.S. To other countries sooner has been the lack of infrastructure to actually start shipping. So you have to have terminals that are equipped to not only get, bring gas to them, to liquefy them, and then you have to get the ships to come there. And so there have been companies, two major companies that I can think of, that have been building these terminals, and the infrastructure takes a number of years. They have to get the capital, they have to get approvals. So finally, some terminals have been built. There are more that are being built. So the infrastructure is getting in place to start exporting more and more.
Cheniere Industries.
Yeah, Cheniere is the big one. There's one called Tellurian.
Cheniere's symbol is LNG.
Yes.
It's and their terminal is offshore in Louisiana.
Yes.
It's the Loop. So there's a thing out there in the Gulf called the Loop, which only thing I know about it is it's a kind of a loading place for petroleum products. And I recall when I was at Rotan Mosley in Houston, they issued a bunch of bonds. State of Louisiana did. And they were tax-exempt bonds, and those were used for construction of the Loop terminal.
Right. So, yeah, these companies, again, these are not recommendations by any means, but these are companies that that have gotten into it. And over the last decade, they've spent time building infrastructure to start exporting liquefied natural gas. So, and this has a number of advantages. A, natural gas is cheaper here. So even if after liquefaction, if the price goes up some, it's still cheaper for many, multiple countries, not just Europe, but other
Asian
countries.
If you could find a place in Europe that would allow you to drill, I mean, you could make so much money off a gas well.
Right.
I don't know that Europe has many gas wells. There's bound to be formations
right.
that hold gas. I mean, you can drill into coal and get what's called coal bed methane. That's what we had at San Juan Basin the SJT symbol we had out west.
Right.
So there's gas in coal.
Right. So this also has geopolitical implications, you know, apart from just economic implications, because European countries have been relying on Russia for their gas, and now they have an alternative, which will have, you know, long-term consequences for, you
know. If they could drill, they could, and if they allowed themselves, I know Germany's, because they got coal mines there, right. And, you know, there's gas.
Right. There has to be, yes.
Yeah.
Even the border of Germany and France, the Alsace and Lorraine, I think that's
it. Alsace-Lorraine.
Yes, I think there's
mines
there. So, I mean, this, I think, is a very positive thing, not just for the industry, but also for the consumers in other parts of the world. And the industry has been in a terrible shape because natural gas prices have been so low for so long where there was no incentive for them
right.
to. And now, you know, this sort of puts a little bit of a floor where companies can forecast and allocate more capital to getting some of this gas and, you know, shipping it.
I remember, I think it was the summer, I'm sorry, the winter of 1976. I was in college at Suwannee, and we had a very cold spell that lasted a long time, like 20s to teens for a month and a half solid. And what happened was there was so much natural gas being used, and the pipeline system was so undeveloped at that time that most of the natural gas being used in Tennessee and Kentucky was coming up from the Gulf Coast, and they the pipeline pressure dropped from, you know, what it normally is, maybe 200-300 psi to probably in the 20s or teens. That meant there wasn't as much gas coming through. And I know up at Suwannee, they cut the heat in the dorms way back. We were sitting around in the dorms, and it was in the 50s. And we got used to it. I mean, you know, the schools in Nashville had to be canceled for a month.
Wow.
Why? They could not get the natural gas up the pipe and into, you know, schools with a lot of gas to heat it. And it was too cold. And because of the cold and the prolonged amount of cold, the gas pressure in the pipelines dropped severely.
Right.
We're not dealing with that these days.
No, and I mean, technology's gotten so much better.
Plus, we have gas other places than the Gulf Coast.
Right. That's right, yes. And the reality of the situation is, you know, I mean, yes, if companies, people want to use renewable energy or solar or whatever, that's fine. But it takes time for those sources to become viable. They have to be available. But in the meanwhile, you know, we have something like natural gas, which is cleaner than coal, and it's abundantly available.
And cleaner than refined petroleum also, because
right.
it doesn't require all the steps that it takes to refine gasoline.
Right.
I mean, I think the two best fuels are natural gas and diesel, those two. I'm not a big gasoline fan. I mean, I'm way more of a diesel fan. Despite the fact that it's more expensive, I still think it's a better fuel. Doesn't require near as much refining.
Right. I wonder what makes it more expensive if it doesn't require.
Well, I think
we were having this discussion.
I don't know.
Right.
I'm not exactly sure why.
Could it have to do with the semi trucks and?
No, I think it's because not as much diesel is used. Therefore, if there were more volume, it would probably be cheaper.
Right. There's not as much refining capacity.
Yeah, that's what it is. I think. Anybody in the market could tell you something about it, but you know, we have. There's a tremendous amount of disinformation and outright lies concerning the energy industry. It comes primarily from the left and a lot of people in government that say that the energy industry is destroying the environment and causing global warming and those kind of things. The fact is, if you have a major volcano, it spews more greenhouse gases into the environment than 30 or 40 years worth of all car traffic in the world. And these things happen frequently. There is, in places like Canada, every time there's spring comes around, the permafrost thaws a little bit, there's a breakdown and methane is released. There's, you know, methane is a part of the of nature. CO2 is a part of nature. This idea that we should sequester CO2 and pull it out of the environment, just absolutely foolish. And then when you learn about the oil and gas industry and the amount of risk and expertise and just pure know-how that is involved in getting a barrel of oil or natural gas out of the ground and getting it through the pipeline and getting it refined, it's almost a technological miracle.
Right.
And nobody on the left or in government recognizes this. They just want to vilify the oil company. They don't take into account the kind of risk that's required and the expertise that's been developed over so many years, and what's gone on in drilling and extraction that's been the result of technology. I tell you, it's truly amazing.
It is, yeah.
Well, we have had a good conversation this hour, and Adarsh, thanks for helping us along. It's a lot of talking to do when you're running solo. Michael,
yeah, you talked more than you have about the last five shows.
That's true, yeah. But we used to do one-on-one.
I know.
Well, and the thing about Adarsh is he has so much vast knowledge. These are the kind of conversations we have around Dupree Financial Group every day about the investments
How
we make.
How would he not? He reads all the time.
Well, when he's not reading, he's talking. If you'd like to talk to Tom, you can always reach him at 859-233-0400 or at tdupree@dupreefinancial.com. We'd love to take a look at your portfolio. In this time of volatility, it never hurts to have another set of eyes to take a look at what you're invested in, and you really need to know what you own. We appreciate you listening to the Tom Dupree Show, and we will talk to you next week.